philosophers in space, 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 space.
Oops, ain't gonna cut it, Mr. Glowing Visage, beautiful beyond all description.
These are my disposables, exposition and comic relief.
No functions.
Darling, those are genders.
I would like to see the baby.
If it makes you feel any better, the apocalypse is coming soon. Bury your gold. You've been buying gold, right?
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 194, and it's been, for us, it's been a while. I'm not going to lie. It's been a minute since we've recorded.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Oh, yeah. Sure, yo, mate. It's been bangers and mash, eh?
Do you remember how this one goes? Is this the dad one? What is this show?
Yeah. How many shows do you have at this point, right? Do you just like spin the wheel and, you know,
I just, somebody just tells me what one I'm on. I just start talking. It's fine. Mm-hmm. No nonsense. Mm-hmm. This is I definitely know the name. It's gonna come to me anyway. This is let's see,
Dads in Space.
No, I already said it. Philosophers in Space.
And philosophers.
We are finally. I am told one thing I didn't know though. I thought we did an episode on The Boys season one, but I guess we didn't.
Yeah, I don't think we did unless we did in a previous universe and not a universe we're currently living in.
We do tend to have a universe issue with this show.
We do sometimes. We did episode 182 on the cartoon short story about the couple that is, the wife is sick, and that was really, you know, I don't want to say fun. I always go to the term fun when I'm going to describe an episode, but that was not a fun episode, but I think a valuable episode.
Sure. But I want to put one out there for the people who always think I hate everything, even though I don't. I love The Boys. I think it's a phenomenal show.
It's a bangers and mash from the beginning.
And it keeps getting better, too. Like, I think I like each season maybe better than the last. Or it's, maybe season two is the best one, to be honest. Like, season two was really, really good. I think season two was great. It's close. I can't decide. But either way, it's such a solid show.
Yeah. Really, I think I watched season two and I was like, that's one of the darkest, most messed up seasons of television I've ever seen. And then I watched like the first half of season three and I was like, nope, I was wrong. Yep, that was not, in fact, the darkest, most messed up thing I've ever seen. I do think all three of the seasons build beautifully. We didn't do the first season because I think we just felt like there wasn't like a strong philosophical hook there. It's a great season, but it's really sort of standard in a sense. A lot of the stuff that we've covered before, things like Watchmen, lots of other anti-hero, anti-superhero stuff. But
I'm pretty sure The Boys was one of those ones where it was one of the ones that happens all the time where I'm like, you know, it'd be a great premise.
Right.
Superheroes, except they're assholes or something. And then I'll do that and someone will be like, that already exists. It's already this thing. That's happened like 10 times. And I think that was The Boys. I think that was kind of how I glommed onto that. Because I think it is a great premise. It really is ripe for the pickings. Just the fact that, like, you've got superheroes, except they're normal people, or like they're bad people, or, you know, and the question is, like, would that kind of ultimate power just make anyone an asshole? Like, who knows? And there's all kinds of good stuff, but we're going to talk about season two and we're going to focus on one of my favorite storylines in the entire of all the seasons, which is Stormfront.
Yeah.
I remember watching this and with The Boys, like, it's obviously there's a ton of very, you know, there's a ton of great allegory, satire. Sometimes it's a little on the nose, you know, I think would be my only complaint, but not like terribly so. Sometimes it's a little like, all right, we're just directly doing like the real world now. And that's
right.
You know, because the real world has
season.
Gotten so bad. I guess it's understandable. But the Stormfront thing, it was really interesting watching that. First off, Stormfront, fantastic name. I mean, coming up with that for like the name of the superhero and her superhero stuff is storm related. Yep. It's a great tie-in.
Yep. Yeah. We'll definitely talk about that for sure.
Yep. Well, I guess we should get into it. Why do we?
Well, before we do, I do want to. There were a couple of like tie-in things I wanted to mention and a few correction things I wanted to mention before we got rolling on the exposition zone. While we were away, we released some episodes, which were all amazing, and there were absolutely no problems, except maybe we got a few things wrong about the Culture series that we might have gotten some feedback on, the most specific one of which, I don't think we actually necessarily said this wrong or not, maybe we did, but just to clarify for folks who aren't familiar, the Culture is not actually a descendant of Earth Culture. That was something that, like, I think people could have the wrong mindset that, like, these are just normal Earthlings being controlled by AI or something like that, when we don't actually get, I think, a fully detailed account of the physical, like, they're humanoid-ish or something like that. But time-wise, the book we read, Consider Phlebas, actually takes place in 1331 CE, so, like, feudal, like, Middle Ages period, and the books go as far forward as 3K. So I just wanted to mention that because I whether or not we got it clear enough or not, I do think it is an interesting part of the story that, like, in this universe, Earth doesn't matter and is, like, not part of, like, any of this. Like, this isn't, like, and you know, it follows up on the idea that we were talking about where Banks was looking for, like, an anti sort of nationalist, anti-fascist approach to these space operas, and so making it not like the grand empire that arises from Earth, like, I think deflates that possibility to some extent.
Okay. Well, that's not related to the boys at all.
No, but I wanted to give that correction because we did those things before, you know.
If you say so, I'm all in a different universe now. I can't take responsibility.
Right, you don't even remember any of the things that we did.
That was Thomas B. A. What's the numbering for the, right. Fantastic Rick and Morty joke? Yeah, that guy. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, he's the worst.
C-verse, yeah.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention, I think it's worth announcing that we can loosely tie this in terms of bad British accents, but we're going to both be at QED in October.
This is true things.
Right. And so anybody in the vicinity of Manchester at the end of October should come hang out. And I think you're doing a live SIO.
Yeah.
I'm doing a panel. I'm sure there will be some other, you know, shenanigans.
Yeah, shenanigans panel. They ought to do one of those. No, I'm also doing a parenting panel with Eli and some other people.
Oh, cool.
Semi-related to Dear Old Dad. So
I
was kind of just hoping to not even do anything. It's such a good conference. I would just go and be an attendee and just, like, hang out and have fun. But then, you know, like, I also like doing stuff. So it's close. It's so good. The point is, it's such a good, fun conference that I was going to go no matter what. Like, even if they were like, hey, we hated what you did last time and we don't like your kind here. Right. I'd be like, well, I can still buy a ticket though, right?
Right.
That's how fun it is. So make sure especially if you live in Europe, this is a rare, easier chance to see a lot of your favorite American podcasters.
Yep. I wasn't going to make it to the one that got canceled. So I'm excited to get to make it to this one and be doing some stuff. The other one thing I wanted to just mention, and I promise we'll get to the exposition zone. This particular conversation I think we're about to have ties in particularly well with episode 250 of Embrace the Void that I just released, which is a, you know, nice large round number episode. And it was an interview.
Congrats.
Thank you. With Brittany Page of I Doubt It podcast. And for folks who haven't gotten to listen to the episode yet, Brittany was literally raised by Nazis.
Oh,
and
wow.
So, yeah, we talk about her experience growing up in a family that lived near and, you know, was part of and connected to the Aryan Nation, and, like, how she sort of escaped that stuff. And, like, they do really great stuff on their podcast politically now, and a lot, you know, they often tie in conversations about how the modern right is sort of saying a lot of things out loud that used to be things that were only said sort of in quiet in her house. So I think there's a lot of good connections there for folks who are wanting to hear a little bit more about, like, the making of a Stormfront.
And that's interesting because I think, now that I think about it, I'm sure I'm not the only one tuned in here or on the show that was raised conservative or grew up conservative. I'm sure there's a number of us out there. And I think it's really interesting to look at the contrast between the ideology, like the conservative ideology that we're going to see in the season when we talk about Stormfront, that is embodied in the greatest quote of probably my favorite quote of Stormfront's. And maybe we can kind of tease it with this, where she says, people love my ideas. They just don't like the word Nazi.
Right.
And it's 100% true, because I was probably raised more with the mainstream conservative ideology, which in my opinion basically is that they do love a lot of those ideas. But they would genuinely, legitimately be horrified if you're like, well, you're a Nazi. They'd be like, oh my God, no, right. No, I'm not that. You know, yeah. So that's interesting. I think we can use that perfect. And get going in our exposition zone.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
So I don't think we're going to cover like the Boys plot per se, right? Do we kind of want to stick to her storyline?
Yeah, I think we can say roughly that like this season in the arc of the show is like a beginning of a confrontation between Homelander and like the main, like, I guess we should say a little bit of the characters that are in this show, right? Because we haven't even introduced some of these folks. So like, you know, and we should obviously, I think, start with Homelander, because prior to Stormfront, the reason you're watching this show is for Homelander. Like Anthony Starr is putting in my opinion, an Emmy-worthy performance where he is horrifying. He is deep and interesting.
Oh, I've been meaning to say this. He is legitimately the only villain I've ever been scared of, like in anything. I don't care.
Terrifying.
Because anything else, I don't really get scared by make-believe, if I'm being honest. I just don't. Like, I'm just like, yeah, that's a make-believe.
Oh, one. Yeah, me too.
But
yeah,
he's real. Like, you know, like the concept of something. He's a stand-in for the United States, obviously. Like, and I think in season one, that's kind of where it starts is kind of, he's a stand-in for the United States. He's this all-powerful, you know, but like bungling, making problems way worse kind of character. And it just gets scarier and scarier. And by the time season three, I'm not going to tease anything. Mm-hmm. The ending of season three was bone chilling. Absolutely bone chilling. Mm-hmm. And like
the beginning of season three was bone chilling. There's a scene in the first half of season three that was maybe the most messed up thing I've ever had to watch, and we'll talk about it at length in the next episode for sure. But like, yeah, woof. He is horrifying,
scariest villain of all time. It's that meme, like I think it's from The Incredibles. Like I don't really give a shit about fictional villains, but that thing scares me.
Yeah, and the degree to which he always comes off as like a deeply, deeply damaged child who does desperately want to be loved and respected.
Exactly.
But, you know, I think he has one quote at one point where he's like, I want to be loved, but I'll accept being feared or something like that. And you just totally believe it. I think my favorite part about him are his suppressed anger reacts. Yeah. Like, I think we are all Homelander's suppressed anger reacts at this point.
And I think it morphs a little bit from being, and I think in season one, and maybe, you know, you're better at this kind of thing, but he does seem to be more of a stand-in just for kind of the U.S. foreign policy, like having all this power and just using it terribly, maybe, always thinking you're the good guy. And a lot of people also thinking you're the good guy when you're really not. In season two, which is the focus of today, I feel like he's a little bit more a stand-in for Trumpism than in season one, I would say. Don't you think? Because the marriage of him and Stormfront, I think, is the or just if not Trumpism, just like, I don't know, like conservative Republican ideology kind of thing, because there's this interplay of Stormfront, who's, well, very obviously she's a Nazi. It's in the name.
Apparently not obviously enough, because there were a lot of people who were really surprised to find out that this character. Yeah. So let me describe for a second. Right. Like Stormfront is introduced as the new member of this team of seven, which, you know, the show all centers around the superhero team. And before I talk about that, let me just back up and say, I think you're right that in this one, it's definitely MAGA and GOP. In the first season, it is a little bit of like, I think it's, I would say, conservative America, let's say,
because
it's all capitalism and like jingoism, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The important thing is that these superheroes all work for a company called Vought, which is like actually using all of this to just make a bunch of money, right? Like that's the real moral, that's the real goal of all of it. But yeah, in this season we get Stormfront, who is a true believer, we find out, right? And like she shows up and they describe her as being, they originally call her as being from like somewhere else, and then they correct her as she's from Portland. She's been working in Portland, and she like comes in and she has what's called, what is called, I believe, the fash is the correct term for the this fash. Haircut it's a fash, it's, undercut,
but it's like a
slightly alt-right, so there are different versions of this. Hers is a little bit more like alt haircut, like the kind of.
All right, let's not get all judgy on the haircuts. She looked. She.
Well, what I need you to
looks really good. Okay,
though.
I'm just saying it's a good haircut.
You're right.
We don't. Yeah. We don't let the Nazis take our haircuts. You know, right? Well, maybe that mustache. They took that mustache. The mustache. They. That's dead. They've taken that. Hitler killed that. But like, come on, the undercut, the hot undercut. So, it's such a good hairstyle.
Here's the thing. Her version is semi-ambiguous, right? The proper fash undercut is like the hair falls over the like the buzzed vert part of it, and the idea is that you're like covering up your skinhead like nature or something like that. So if you look up like Richard Spencer has a classic fash fash undercut, and hers though is a little bit like alti, right? Like if you saw her and you heard Portland and you didn't know her name, she could go either way, right? It could be like she's the new Antifa or something like that, right? But like the name Stormfront is such a giveaway. Like for folks who are not familiar, this is the name of the website that is the biggest. I think they may have gotten shut down at some point. But
yeah, I think it is shut down.
Yeah, I think it did get shut down, but like was the biggest white nationalist website online before that became, you know, Gab or whatever it is, you know, whoever's servicing their needs
social.
At this point.
Yeah,
right, True Social. So yeah, like to be revealed in that way, to me, I'm like, oh, awesome, we're doing the Nazi thing. Like we're fully doing the Nazi thing now. But like they do sort of slow burn it over the first half of this season a little bit. Do we want to introduce any of the other characters, or just sort of as we go along, I guess we can just toss them in?
I think we got to make
really
a decision to not try to do the whole boys, because could get really bogged down on the characters and what they want and what they've done.
The relationship between these two is all that really matters.
Honest. I think it's important to establish that one of the constraints on Homelander as a character, because it is difficult to keep him constrained. Just I think in the writing, it is a little difficult because he's all powerful and he's a man child who's a horrible narcissist and there's a lot of times where you're like, why doesn't he just kill everybody? But like one of the ways they try to constrain the character is he's very concerned with his metrics, his numbers, like how many people like him, you know, nationally. And, you know, there's the movies, there's the Marvel universe. That's basically all of them. I love that part of the show. Like the seven, they are real superheroes, but there's also like a Marvel universe movie stuff of them, you know, that's like side by side with that, which I love. And so he is a bit constrained by wanting people to like him somewhat and wanting to be popular. And the big, The sort of the big thing that happens in this season with that is Stormfront comes along and she's able to, and this is where it's just very, you know, very on the nose kind of satire, but she comes in and she's able to drive these big numbers for her with almost no effort. Like Homelander has Vought, this giant corporation behind him. So he's like the mainstream Republican. He's like the Jeb, almost the Jeb Bush kind of.
Right.
And Stormfront comes along and she's got a couple guys just doing memes for her. And like that, like just completely takes over. But she doesn't achieve like universal love or anything. She just does. It's very on the nose for Trumpism. It's like she comes in and she makes some memes and the big money can't really touch her. And a lot of people hate her, but enough people feel strongly about her that she makes this big impact. And so a lot of the conflict, and not necessarily conflict, but a lot of the of what's going on with Homelander in this season is him kind of figuring that out. And eventually, at first, he wants to like just take her out and he hates her. But then he sees what she's able to do in terms of, you know, the audience and the social media and all of that. Yep. And she kind of convinces him like, no, let's work together. Like I'll be the kind of hated you know, loved and hated, extreme polarizing figure. And, you know, we can play off each other and you can keep doing what you're doing. So it is a little on the nose, but it's also very good.
Perfect. Well, I think she beautifully captures, there's a line in there in the meme wars stuff that you're talking about where she basically explains to him anger sells. And she says, you have fans, I have soldiers. And right. I do think that like there's an interesting duality to Stormfront and to the kind of internet MAGA world, which is this mix of like very detached nihilism that you see in the kind of like meme culture and the like extremely not detached white supremacism that is like, it is really, really, really important that we prevent white genocide. And we take that part very, very seriously, but we use this kind of nihilism. And this is very accurate. We use the nihilism as like a cover, like we joke about this and then, and, you know, the people who might be interested sort of take the joke seriously. And that's how you build stochastic terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And they do in this season a really beautiful job of setting up an event that is, you know, the kind of stochastic terrorism that people like myself who do conspiracism stuff are often worried about. So folks haven't heard that term. It refers to the kind of getting people to commit like violent acts without explicitly inciting them, right? So essentially,
yeah, it's like
repeatedly demonizing a group, right? You know, setting things up in such a way where this thing will happen, essentially. And I think people like Tucker Carlson are perfect examples of this, and bear, you know, Alex Jones, people bear some significant responsibility for the harm that they cause. Yeah. And there's that one part with the montage where like Stormfront is out there doing like a media blitz, and it ends up with a guy shooting a like clerk in a store because he thinks that he's an evil superhero or a supervillain.
Yeah. There's the demagoguery of the quote unquote supervillains. It's just pretty much, yeah, again, this is really on the nose, but it's pretty much, you know, Trump's thing with the border and with immigrants. They do it, but with supervillains, you know, kind of thing.
I love Homelander so much. There's a running gag throughout this season where they keep trying to make it super terrorists as like a you know, war on terror shtick. And he's like, it should be supervillains. It obviously should be supervillains.
Yeah. And I do like more of the stuff that I think is really interesting about kind of what he's the stand in for. I like his not really realizing that she's a Nazi. You know, it's kind of a slow.
Yeah. It's kind he's of a the slow, last one across the finish line.
And I think he even, if I'm remembering correctly, I think he even has about the reaction that he is the stand in for on the right, which is, I think he is horrified by some of the beliefs somewhat. You know, he's like, oh, that's not what, you know, but he doesn't ultimately care that much. It's just he cares about the results, you know. And what,
yeah,
and
you
what
actually,
is good. Go ahead.
Yeah. I totally agree. I think it's really beautifully done where, and she soft walks him too. Like it's a beautiful portrayal of radicalization. Yes. So like early on, she's all like American exceptionalism where she has one of my favorite quotes that I kept was, you just need a little help connecting with your audience, change with the times, God knows I did, right? Yeah. That she's just essentially the evolving of this position. But yeah.
Did we even say that she was born in 1919 and... Did we even give all of that?
Right. So we eventually get the reveal, the big reveal of the story. Well, again, for folks who aren't familiar with the Nazis, a big reveal is that, right, she was married to Vought, the guy who founds the company, and she was one of the early test subjects, and she is, you know, what is it, 80 years old or something like that, right?
100 years old, yeah.
100 years old, yeah, right. And... She was hanging around with the Nazis being a Nazi and then like we assume came over here through, I guess, Project Paperclip, right, or something like that.
Oh,
and then ends up
maybe.
I don't know if we get a clear answer on how she got here, but yeah, she comes over, Vought obviously founds the company and she starts out as a different hero for a while.
Yeah.
Which we see. And that's sort of that's part of the whole big reveal of her true identity, I guess, to the five people who couldn't figure it out, including Homelander. Yeah. The most overt scene is in episode 8, where she goes into a speech with his son about white genocide and how you like have to prevent the replacement, essentially.
So Because he, so Homelander has a son who he's trying to teach powers to. He knows that he's going to have powers, but the son can't use them yet. And we won't get into all that because we don't have time. But he's like, hey, it helps. He's trying to teach him the laser eyesight, you know. It's typical Superman powers, basically. And he's like,
right.
It helps if you picture someone you hate. And he's like, yeah, I don't really hate anyone. And then Stormfront comes down and is like, wow, that's really nice, except there are people who want to take us out just because of the color of our skin. And, like, seeing Homelander's reaction to this of, like, oh, what? You know, like, he's not stopping it, but he's also like, wow, okay. It's just such a stand-in for, like, how the mainstream Republicans have had to, like, you know, Trump will say something, and at first they're like, that's not right. And then they see that basically the public goes with him, or their voting block, I guess, goes with him, and then they have to adopt it. It's so funny. She's like, yeah,
he's got a great twitch about it. Well, yeah.
It's called white genocide.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
And like earlier she was doing it where it was like what she actually cared about was the preservation of superheroes. And then it was like, you know, Americans and superheroes, and then it's like white Americans and superheroes.
She does, she does the gaslighting. It's written fantastically because at a certain point, one of the, you know, not villains kind of confronts her, and Stormfront is like, I can't believe you would go against your own people like that. And what's her name? Like, Starlight is like, what, you mean white people? And she's like, no, I meant superheroes. Ugh, racist, you know, doing this total gaslighting. It's so funny.
Right. Yeah, she does the same thing with the black guy who runs really fast, which is a great racist trope in itself.
A-Train, yeah.
Yeah, A-Train.
I love A-Train's character. It's so good.
Yeah, there's so many great characters in the show that we don't have time for. Anyway, so yeah, we get the white Christian nationalism, white genocide stuff from her, and it's sort of, it's an interesting story arc because she's not the big bad in this story. The story is really a story about them trying to kill Homelander. All of the stories, really, like all of the seasons are about that essentially, but like it ends up with them fighting her when they find out that she's like a Nazi when all of this stuff comes out. But like it is a weird sort of anti-climax in a sense where they fight and then like Homelander shows up and just kind of has to accept the reality because of a bunch of like backstory stuff that we don't have time to get into.
Well, no, and I think it's important. I think thematically, once it's out that she's a quote unquote Nazi, that's when we get her line, you know, where she's like, look, people love my ideas. They don't like the word Nazi. And I think he kind of embodies that. It gets to the point where it's sort of like the fact, and I've said this before on something and I don't remember what back in the day, but I think if there was a video that came out where Trump used the N-word, I actually do think that would have swung
made a significant difference.
Yeah, I actually do. Because I think these people are all really convinced that they're not racist. I think they're very convinced. Some of them, like some of the Trumpers, some of the mainstream Republicans are very convinced that they're not racist. They think that I've seen this in people I know who are conservative. They don't think they're racist. They just think racism is true. Like they don't think they're racist. They just think like, oh, you know, certain people aren't as good at certain things or whatever. And they genuinely would be horrified in their minds by someone using the N-word, for example. Like I think that's probably a majority of racists in this country wouldn't think they're racist and wouldn't use the N-word. I think that's overwhelmingly true.
I think if it was a hard enough R on the end, you might be right. There is a great shot at one point when they're driving. There's a sequence in the season where they're doing like a cross-country trip and they're like low profile. And so they're driving through farmland and there's a barn they drive by, which has like a mural of Homelander on it. But instead of his like usual American cape, he has a Confederate flag for a cape.
Yeah.
And I just like that's one of the most beautiful things, because like part of the point, I think, of this season, and we'll sort of this can maybe transition to a little bit towards the philosophy, is that like, you know, there actually isn't any daylight between Homelander and Stormfront. He wants there to be, but philosophically there is not. And that's a big problem for him. And like, I think, you know, you see that continue into the third season in some ways a little bit. But yeah, one other thing I wanted to mention before we do talk philosophy is that another great running gag throughout this season is that this is like the season of female empowerment on the show. There's a bunch of like girls or women get it done or whatever, chicks get it done or something like that is the catchphrase. And there's a whole subplot about the stand-in Wonder Woman coming out as being outed actually by Homelander on television as a lesbian, yeah, as part of like a political stunt. I love Maeve so much. She's amazing. Yeah,
that's kind of season one though, right?
Well, no, but you get a lot of that in this season with the building it into both the like fake narrative thing, but they also do
they do a send up of that scene in Avengers.
Right, exactly. Perfect.
It's the funniest thing of all time because that scene is so it's ripe for parody and it was hilarious. But you're right, we should transition over to allegedly some philosophy on this philosophy show.
Yeah, so let's do it. Don't forget that we have a little bit more time these days because we're doing every other week, so we're going for a little bit longer.
And so, how do we do that? Bop it?
I think I missed something.
Punch it?
I think you missed the other one earlier.
Grocket. No, this is Grocket.
The other one was Bop It, yeah.
Gotcha. It's been a while.
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
All right, so philosophy then. The white Christian nationalism. So we've talked about parts of this before. We've talked about like colonialism and, you know, when we talked about Lovecraft Country and stuff, we got into pieces of this. But I wanted to talk specifically about the role of, since they like explicitly call out great replacement conspiracism in the show, I wanted to talk about what is great replacement conspiracism and like what is the philosophy of white Christian nationalism. I think when we talk about this stuff, we often imagine it as a like incoherent mass of like anger, but there is like a bunch of philosophical positions in these things that I think it's worth refuting so that you don't end up like Homelander, right, and sort of get sucked into this stuff. Because part of what's really horrifying and accurate about folks like Stormfront is lots of people do start out, you know, well, this doesn't seem too implausible, this one claim about the nature of race or something, right? And then they end up, you know, listening to really extreme, you know, white Christian nationalists and getting sucked into these kinds of spaces. So I always try to make it specific that it is white Christian nationalism, all three of those, because I think some folks only talk about one of the three, and I think they often do it for tactical reasons, and I think it's both not the best tactics and misses like the full understanding of this problem, right? That like you can't leave one of, like, so for example, I think sometimes atheists will talk about Christian nationalism, but they'll leave out the white because they don't want to seem, you know, exclusionary or like they'll get dinged for being racist or something like that.
Well,
right?
And there's also a misconception that all white Christian nationalists would have to be white. It's just not true. Like, and it's such a simple, like, oh, how could these, you know, Trumpers be racist? There's a black guy in them. It's like, that's not, it doesn't matter, you know? And I think there is that, I think people are afraid of ever calling anything that might have a person of color in it racist, even though it definitely is.
Yeah, and I always go to my good friend, Representative Alan West, the conservative black former United States representative, who has told stories about how he was literally a member of a white nationalist biker gang. Like, it happens. Wow. There are people who are parts of those communities. And like, there are also people who identify as conservatives and just like other conservatives don't think that they're racist or something like that, right? And they just think that, like, they have views about black culture and those, you know, like they get into like a Thomas Sowell place. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And another example of that I think is important because, you know, when I track a lot of this stuff, I in the past have done stuff about James Lindsay, who joined up with Michael O'Fallon, who is, I would argue, a white Christian nationalist, even though he is of Cuban heritage, right? You also have, I think, the example in the Proud Boys was led by a Cuban American as well. So, like, you can have conservative people of color, and they can be part of racist groups. But I think... you also see folks sort of focusing sometimes on just the white nationalism and leaving out the Christian part, right? Where they want to focus in on like the Nazis or something like that. But I think that's also a mistake that this show makes a little bit, not entirely, right? You don't see a lot of explicit discussion of Christianity in this show.
Yeah, not really. I think that's still a line that a lot of media is not willing to cross.
It is mentioned there subtly, though, so I did catch that there's a charity event at one point, and the charity is called Samaritan's Embrace, and it's a Christian charity that works with Vox, or Vox, excuse me. Yeah, Vox, right? Vot. That works with Vot. So yeah, I do think there is some of that, like, Christian-y stuff there, but it doesn't get talked about, and, like, in particular, the kind of internet MAGA culture that Stormfront represents tends to not be strong on the Christian-y stuff.
Yeah.
Right? That's not where it comes from in the white Christian nationalist community. And I think it's important, though, because there's often this really frustrating canard that, like, Nazis are atheists and Nazis are lefties, right? And the Nazis are atheist one in particular is very frustrating because there really is an important Christian strain to all of this stuff that, like, they believe that Christianity provides the cultural bedrock that has made white culture so successful, and that you can't do away with that. Even if individuals to some extent believe it more or less, it's an important sort of cultural language. That's why you see folks like James Lindsay talking more and more about how, like, maybe Christianity is a key cultural pushback against wokeness or SJWs or something. SJWs get called out quite a bit on this show, which is hilarious.
Yeah. I think there's a lot going on there. I think that, for one, there are just all kinds of conservative ideas that probably have their root in religion and Christianity. But I think they've always long, you know, Christians have long found secular ways to make their arguments. And I think some people are genuinely persuaded by those, even though they're kind of fake arguments. I think there are legitimately atheists out there who are part of this and would never say that they're Christian and think Christianity is stupid, but that, you know, they've been convinced of some ideas that honestly in the end basically share all but in name this Christian ideology. So I think that happens. I think there's also a sense of when you're dealing with extremist groups and fringe ideologies, there's a lot of like finding whatever allies you can, you know? And so like, I think that the people who appealed to James Lindsay, I think probably if he was any other guy, they would hate him for his past atheism or whatever. They would be, you know, not cool with him. But because he's like willing to, he's an ally in their BS, you know, whatever. God knows what conspiracy nonsense they're up to now. But because he's an ally in that, they kind of reach out and soft pedal the parts that, you know, he might disagree with. And you slowly have this merging, you know, and I think that happens too.
Yeah. And I think you bring up something there that is really valuable, which is, I think, the connection between the role of Christianity in this ideology and the rise of our post-truth world. I think there's an important argument that insofar as the Republican Party became the party of white Christian nationalism, the things that it resisted were social change and science, because it had to protect the Christian worldview against the encroachment of evolution and all these other sorts of things. And that, like, our situation now of, like, everyone having a different reality, right? Goes back not just to like 2010 or something like that, right? It goes back to the 60s. It goes back to the beginning of the divide. And then, like, it goes, you know, you see it in full force, I think, in the Teach the Controversy stuff in like the 90s as an attempt to, as you were saying, sort of reintroduce religion with a secular argument. And that Teach the Controversy stuff, for some reason, like, atheists understood that that was a terrible idea at the time, but now have like completely, some of them completely bought into this idea. And it so obviously then provides an open door for bad actors. Like it really, you know, I'm not saying we shouldn't have free discourse and discussion and that sort of thing, but like, you know, there's a whole argument to be had about, this is the paradox of tolerance, right? That at some point you have to prevent the rise of dangerous like actors who are interested in shutting down the democratic process. There was, interestingly, kudos to us for totally planning it this way, but Biden just gave this speech a day or so ago now, I guess.
Yeah.
Where he like called out
where the lighting
MAGA
was
Republicans.
Kind of stark, so it's
well, they made
Hitler.
Some poor choices on the lighting. Yeah, I think we can all agree it was a good abject lesson in
and
lighting.
We
choices.
Can all agree those bad lighting choices are as bad as the thing he's pointing.
The
out.
Most important thing yeah. in the universe. Yes, absolutely. No, yeah, he calls out sort of the MAGA folks who are like unwilling to accept defeat in elections. Like literally, have made it the case where they will not ever view a loss in an election as legitimate. That is a real serious problem. But like when he calls that out, you have all of this like absurd pushback that he's sort of demonizing, that he's, you know, not allowing for open discourse. But like there is a reasonable argument that what do you do when you have a portion of your population who is unwilling to accept democratic outcomes and has at least already once engaged in a massive violent insurrection in an attempt to overthrow a democratic election. Like, what do?
You both sides it.
You both sides it.
Sides it is what
as
you do. We have
hard
learned
as you can.
No lessons from 2016. Absolutely.
We really have not.
They
it's
all didn't.
Depressing.
All the networks didn't carry the speech because they decided it was a political speech. So they didn't carry
it. Is that what they said?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's we've learned nothing.
Yeah, there's a piece to be written about the coddling of the right wing, where like we've gotten so far down the rabbit hole of like, oh well, they're, you know, they're out there and we just need to kind of be really nice to them and that'll reel them back in, to a point where we just literally can't talk about reality anymore without it.
Yeah,
like,
I think
a
that's
a huge problem.
Yeah, that started long ago, and I think people have written that piece. And but keep writing it, you know, like it needs...
Right, keep rewriting it. It'll get there eventually, I'm sure. Bringing this back to the, like the conspiracism stuff, because I think what makes this get really dangerous is the existential threat that is attached to all of this. So you have this idea that's called Great Replacement, or, you know, White Replacement sometimes, or White Genocide, I think is the term she uses in the show. And this would be either an intentional or an unintentional program plan to destroy the right race, right? To get rid of white people, essentially, to, you know, and this one is interesting. This gets a little bit into like philosophy of conspiracism. Like in the modern world, a lot of times, almost always, conspiracies can like glom on to some things that are like actually true. And that makes it harder to address them because it's like, well, look, there's this actual piece of CRT in schools, or there's this actual groomer over it. Like whatever it is, there's always some little nugget of actual harm that can be sort of attached onto there. But, you know, you have the data, for example, that like America isn't going to be a majority white country by a certain date. And then you have people being excited about that, myself included. I wrote about this at The Skeptic at one point because Boghossian and another guy had been like promoting what I would argue is kind of soft Great Replacement conspiracism against liberals, essentially, that like they're going to come and depopulate you. So like in a Malthusian kind of sense that like, some of it, so this overlaps some with depopulation conspiracies. So you have anti-globalist depopulation conspiracies where the idea, you know, folks like James Lindsay, for example, will point out they're going to kill off 5 million people. They don't need us anymore or something like that. They have all the stuff they need or something. So they're going to, or they're going to depopulate us because of, you know, climate change, right? They believe in climate change. So they're going to kill off a bunch of us because Bill Gates is apparently a giant eco-terrorist and he just hasn't figured out how to kill all of us yet or something. And all of this comes together because it's like, well, who are they going to kill the most of? Obviously the white people, because they're also, you know, pro people of color. So, and it's, you know, equity means when we kill people, we're going to have to kill more white people to counterbalance colonialism or something like that. Right. So all of the anti-woke stuff all comes together.
People.
To like what specifically balance things out while committing mass genocide.
Yeah. It's nice of them.
Yeah.
I love that idea. They're cool with genocide, but they want to make sure they're equal about it.
Ethical genocide. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, a common theme in superhero, supervillain kind of stuff, right? The hardcore version of this, when you get into the actual white nationalists speaking overtly, is what's called the 14 words. I don't know if you ever heard that term before.
I have heard that term before.
Yeah, it refers to this following sentence. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. So it's essentially the sort, you know, the catchphrase for the Great Replacement, that it's like you have to protect white people from being overrun by the other races.
I do that, like the way they're general in the beginning, our people, you know, like, oh, they're trying to be, you know, plausible deniability. And then they're like, and the future of white children. I just do white for both of them then. I don't understand why did you do our people at
first? Yes, right. There's a follow-up line to that one too, I found that's interesting, especially for the like chicks get it done portion of this season. The second sentence goes, because the beauty of the white Aryan woman must not perish from the earth. And I think this is valuable because it highlights how these worldviews, they're not just, you know, if we're being really specific, they're not just white Christian and nationalist. They're also misogynistic or chauvinistic. Oh, yeah. They are heavily, you know, male dominated and like view women as sort of objects to be protected and controlled in all these sorts of ways.
Yeah.
And all of that comes together to like give the impression of an existential threat that then can be used to make people think, you know, this is what's coming. If they get control of our politics, they're going to enact laws. They're going to start with small stuff like redistribution of wealth racially, and then it's going to be land, and then they're going to be killing you for your land. You have folks like Tucker Carlson actually overtly using Great Replacement. He actually, I think, just did a segment saying that this is real, basically. So, you know, this is a really frightening thing where, like I was saying, you know, when I chatted with Brittany on ETV, that like a lot of the stuff that was talked about quietly in the back in the other days, right now is like very much out in the open and part of the mainstream politics of the right here. So all that being said, right, the funnest thing I thought we could do here would then be to play a little bit of hot Nazi advocate and like,
of course you would think that,
right? Well, I think there's a fun game to be played in like, how do you undermine this argument? Like, what is the actual way to object properly to Stormfront's position? And I'm curious sort of what arguments you would lay out. Now I'll open with this volley, right? To put it in superhero terms, for folks who are not familiar, there's another character in Marvel called Magneto. He is maybe one of the most famous mutants of all time, right? He controls metal and he is a Holocaust survivor. And he basically is like, we want to kill off all the humans because they will kill off the mutants. And it's like, there's a lot of, is he wrong though? Kind of stuff about Magneto, right? A lot of like, well, he did go through the Holocaust and he did, you know, X, Y, Z and stuff. Like, he maybe has a little bit of a point. And then the question becomes, how do you genuinely distinguish between Magneto and Stormfront? If Stormfront genuinely believes that like white people, like mutants, like Jews, deserve to be protected and preserved, and she believes that they are at risk, what is the argument against this position, do you feel like?
Why does it matter if she believes it? I feel like, I don't know why intent is a big deal here. I think it's not a position that I would argue with by caring about whether or not she believes it. I think I would start with like, what are the examples that she's been fed by Tucker Carlson you know, 1920s Tucker Carlson, which I'm sure was just every single broadcaster.
Right.
But I don't believe that this is some sort of Philip philosophical position that people reach in a vacuum very much. I think what they do is they're fed a bunch of scary anecdotes that make them, because humans are so prone to this, like whatever we see enough, we think like, oh, that's happening. So they're fed a bunch of news stories about violence in black cities and Chicago and the guns and the blah. And they're fed so much of that until it becomes more plausible to them that, okay, well, I guess there's just something violent and wrong about these people.
Right, but that's still a philosophical argument. It's a terrible one that you don't like, and it's made through specious means. But like in the sense of it being an argument, right, they're still getting people from a premise to a conclusion via quote-unquote evidence.
Yeah, but I guess there's a difference between when there's an argument that you think is wrong or that is wrong. There's a difference between, oh, there's a mistake in your logic here versus, oh, you're just starting with a bunch of bad data. I think that you kind of approach, I guess my point is you approach those different ways. Like I would need to, you really aren't going to talk someone out of this by pointing out the problem with their reasoning or with the step in their logic. I think it's more about like, you've got to take a lot of time to deprogram them on all of the just misinformation they've been fed. Don't you think? There's a distinction
there. I think
it's
complicated. I think we don't actually know exactly how to help people in these situations, to be honest. So here's what I'll say. First of all, I think there's a good pushback to be had against the information deficit model, which is the idea that what these people just lack is information, and that if you just provided them the right facts instead of the Tucker Carlson facts, that would fix the problem, which is somewhat of what you're getting at, I think, when you talk about sort of the emotion-laden nature of those narratives, that these are kind of narrative-based mindsets, and so they have to be kind of pushed back on sort of with narratives potentially, or to some extent, or that like it at least is the case that like just correcting. So like it wouldn't work in my opinion to be like, well, what is your evidence for this? Because they're going to provide you a bunch of stories. You're going to debunk those stories. They're going to provide you more stories. You're going to debunk those stories, but they're still going to have the feeling, right? The feeling won't go away. So it's like, how do you address the feeling? And I think you can address the feeling a little bit through argument, right? The same way they're using emotion and feeling to make and defend an argument, you can also, I think, sort of make reference to you can use arguments in a way that might help a person feel less emotionally stressed out. It might not involve like convincing them of a different set of facts. It might involve like helping them, you know, feel less attached to certain kinds of values potentially, or something like that, right? They might feel like there's a value that's a threat, but you might help them realize that like that the value, the thing you actually care about, is not at threat. It's just been masked by this other thing. So to bring it back to the show a bit, right? If they're successful in taking Nazi ideas and making them synonymous with the Homelander style American nationalism in a way that, you know, in the MAGA people's minds, like if you claim that this particular thing is a racist idea, they will, sort of be triggered and defend it in that kind of way. That can be a real problem, but maybe if you at least highlight to people this is a laundered version of this other thing that is coming from literal actual Nazis, maybe providing that information can change their perspectives a little bit. Like, you know, like it's a little bit naive, I think, on the show, the way that they reveal her background and it just suddenly destroys her. Like, I don't think that would actually be how it would work in reality. I think she could easily sort of deflect the attack as like, oh, well, yeah, I was that way, but I changed or I reformed or something, you know, and like,
I don't know. I'm not sure that's true.
You don't think so?
No, I think I like that part of the show. Because I love that they had her be like a literal Nazi that's just been frozen in time to show that like, yeah, man, these ideas are literal Nazi ideas. You've just put a new haircut on it. You know, you've just given her a sexier haircut and made her look modern. They're Nazi ideas. And I think if there was a tape where Trump was using the N-word, it would have made a difference. Again, I'm not saying, I don't define making a difference by all of a sudden every MAGA asshole stops, right, like in a Disney movie. And it's like, oh, I guess we were wrong. It's more like, I think there's enough people in sort of the, like, I won't say the middle, but in the, like, not as far radical parts of these things that went through public school and that are like, yeah, Nazi equals bad. Like, yeah, that's totally true. To where if you learn someone was an actual Nazi, I think there would be enough of a blowback to create problems, electorally or otherwise, popular problem. Again, that's not the same as saying everybody would instantly be like, we all realize they're wrong. But I do think that they've done a good job. I think it's a testament to how well these people are disguising these clearly Nazi ideas as some new thing, you know?
Right. And you bring up another interesting thing here. I know we're getting short on time, but like the way they deal with Stormfront is actually raises the two fundamental approaches for Nazis, like separate from the like arguing, which, you know, I think you're right, is not going to be the best way, though I also think it's important to do outreach to some extent. Like, I think there are people like Brittany who start out in those places but don't end up there. And part of the reason they don't end up there is because someone reached out a hand and gave them an alternative at some point, you know. So the two ways they deal with her, right? First, they dox her, essentially. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, when Unite the Right rally happened, that's a mouthful of ridiculous Nazism, at UVA, there was a lot of work online to find the people who were there, figure out who they were, get them, you know, outed in their communities, get them fired, like essentially have a social cost for being a Nazi in this kind of way. And then you have, of course, the other version, which is punch a Nazi, right? So they end this season with literally a bunch of the women all like standing around punching, which is another sort of throwback to that Avengers end scene as well. So like, you know, we've talked, I think, before a little bit about like the ethics of punching Nazis. I think we actually did an episode or something, maybe covered that a while back. But anyway, I think the question of doxing Nazis is one that's been of interest to me recently. I was reading Culture Warlords, Talia Levine's book about the white supremacists and like the, you know, and she talks about the Antifa folks who do this work of like trying to get people fired and stuff. And I have very mixed feelings about this approach. And
really?
I do.
I don't think I do, but I'd be curious. I'm all for doxing Nazis and getting them fired.
I guess my concern is if you take a Nazi and you socially ostracize them and economically ostracize them more, they will just turn to the other Nazis for support or turn to violence, is my concern. Like I'm not sure you're giving them a good out there. Like, I don't like, is especially when you don't have like control over like, are we going to do like a restorative justice, like sit down and have a conversation about the people you've hurt kind of thing, or is this just going to be like this person just gets thrown out of their job and like no one will talk to them? And like, is that a good approach? Is it the right approach? Is it ethical? Like, especially when we take into account the sort of constitutive luck stuff that I'm always talking about, where it's like these people often end up in these places because they were already coming from a place of feeling disempowered or emotionally isolated or needing to feel special or something like that. And they already have a persecution complex. So like, to what extent are you feeding that? But then of course, if you continue with that logic long enough, you end up at the place that I was just criticizing us for being in, where we're not able to say anything critical about MAGA or anything because we're concerned about radicalizing them further. So like, I don't know that we have a solution. And I think there's an escapism to the show where it's like, oh, well, the solution is they punch her a bunch and then the little kid blows her up.
except that I think that it's still pretty horrifying. Yeah, they do basically get an easy out from the literal Nazi. That's true.
Right.
But you're still left with Homelander, and you're still left with, in season three too, like the same constituency of people that have been kind of radicalized on those ideas still believe in those ideas.
Yeah, you do see it carry through. And you also have, like Stormfront doesn't die at the end of this season, so you have a bit of the like also some of the creepiest, weirdest, most horrifying scenes I've ever in season three to talk about. Tease that if it counts as a tease, I guess.
In terms of it's late in the day to bring up to freshly this argument of doxing Nazis, but I guess I would be of the opinion that some ideas are bad enough that, like, while it is true that as a society I firmly believe we do need to give people the off ramp to change, and we need to give people a chance to change and be a part of society, but they can't do that if they're still Nazis. Like, you still have to do the part where consequences are bad enough for them to want to change. And I do think it actually is maybe the most powerful thing to see, hey, these ideas are not okay in polite society. Like, they just aren't. I'm sorry. I'm not going to employ you. I talk about the interest of the employer, not to get all capitalistic, not have to have employed a Nazi, you know, like I think,
right.
I suppose you could put the decision level at like, is it if you or I have this information, should we share it online or something? And then I guess from the employer's standpoint, it's more about like whether or not they get the information or something. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think that it is powerful to be shown that these ideas are not okay in polite society. And unfortunately, I think we are kind of all that dumb as a society that that's actually what we need. And it's harder to argue people out of these things in some other way.
So you're just full on pro cancel culture here is what you're saying.
Yeah, for literal Nazis, sure.
For literal Nazis. And of course, then the argument becomes, well, you call everyone you don't like a Nazi, right? So obviously
call everyone I don't like a Nazi.
Well, you know what I mean, though, right? Like, yeah. It's made easier in the show that she's a literal Nazi. But like,
the people who marched on Charlottesville or whatever.
Right. You know? But I want to even say that, like, look, we need to understand that Douglas Murray is if we're going to talk Nazi, right, like he's promoting great replacement conspiracism, right? These I did another piece for The Skeptic. I was talking about Shermer and Murray, and like they are mainstreaming this stuff. They're not using those exact words, but they're talking about immigrants flooding into Europe.
Yeah,
and
if
like,
I could fire them, I would.
Right. And like, again, I think it's important to understand they have a coherent worldview, right? Like, I think sometimes folks get a misimpression about this. They really do believe that, like, there are these legitimate differences in race or culture, however you want to parse that particular, you know, point of the argument, and that like if you allow for too much of one and not enough of the other, it will swamp that culture and it will replace it with a worse culture or a worse group of people or something. Mm-hmm. And to go back to playing hot Nazis advocate here for a second, there are versions
of all
of these arguments.
Did we mention that Stormfront is hot? I don't think we even mentioned that. She's insanely hot in the show.
You're just
it's
teasing,
very
After Dark here.
You keep saying hot Nazi. I imagine some of the people listening might be confused as to why you're saying that. I'm just saying the reason is because
we need to be clear about this. Yes.
Stormfront, the character, is insanely hot somehow. Right. I don't know why they made that choice, but it's uncomfortable, and maybe that's why they made the choice. I don't know.
Right. You know, but going back to the problem of how do I tell that I'm different from the other people, right? Everyone thinks that, like, I think to some extent, unless you're like a radical cultural pluralist, right, you would rather your culture not be overtaken by Nazis. So you clearly think that Nazi culture is worse than not Nazi culture.
Well, what's culture, though? Are we talking? Because I would separate ideology from culture.
Well, so these folks won't, right? For them, race, culture, and ideology, and that's why it's white Christian nationalism in particular. Race, culture, ideology, and location are all connected in these people's minds. So one of the most common phrases in Nazi ideology is blood and soil. Mm-hmm. The idea that the blood is directly connected to the soil, and that best people are in the right places and stuff like that.
Right. I do think that there's maybe a bit of a hierarchy, though, in these things. I think race is the most important thing to these people. I think they obviously, they hate us SJWs who are going to replace them or whatever. But like, I do think there is an order to they would take a society, a racially, quote unquote, racially pure society, and just assume that they can either overpower us or like re-educate us or something. I do think that like at the heart of it, race is way more important to them than ideology. And that's why it's blood and soil, I think.
I guess I agree with you that race is sort of the central term that they will focus on. I think it's important to understand that for them, race is a signifier that contains these other ideas to some extent, that there is a connection between.
Oh, that's it. I think it goes the other way. That's interesting.
I would say that for them, whiteness is Christendom and is Europeanness and is these other things that when you ask them, it's not skin color. Like some of them will point to skin color, but like they won't stick to skin color the way they will stick to this weird conglomerate of like ideas about, you know, white Western culture kind of thing.
Yeah, don't you think a lot of that is just them trying to find the terms that we're okay with? You know, a Western culture, Enlightenment culture, you know?
Yes and no. I actually do think that, like, they see this grand tradition in their mind of European whites.
Yeah.
Like, creating modern civilization and then getting blamed for it because colonialism, essentially. And they think that that is sort of an unfair history, and that it is this kind of like superheroes being suppressed by people who are jealous of them, like your Nietzsche and Ubermensch kind of idea. I really do think that like there's a line from one of the critical theorists who's literally like, he says, it sounds oversimplifying, but whiteness is Christianity, is European, is heteronormative for these people. Like, it's all the same for them. It's all fundamentally interconnected. But yeah, I mean, they will use the term race, the racial terms probably more when they can get away with it, right? And then they'll couch it in other terms when they can't. But yeah,
and
I think
a lot of it is just having made these associations, which is deeply racist.
I like to actually reference The Exorcist on this one. There's a great line in The Exorcist when the old exorcist comes in and the young one's trying to tell him about all the different demons that he's encountered inside of the child, and the father stops him and just says, "No, look, there's just the one, right? There's just Satan."
Nice.
To me, these are all just one, right? These are fundamentally interconnected things. You can talk about different aspects of it, but like it's all one ideology, which is why I wanted to talk about this, is because I do think it's important to see how Homelander's American exceptionalism succumbs to this, because it isn't really separate from it. Like, he's not conscious of the other parts of it, but there is no American exceptionalism, in my opinion, separate from the white Christian nationalist stuff.
Yeah, I think that's true.
All right. I guess I realize we're a little over, but we're going longer, so that's great. So should we maybe wrap up here and get to the after darkies?
It's time to get to the after dark. What's our preview for next show?
Yeah, so we're sticking with The Boys because it's such a good show. Okay. We're going to do the third season next. We'd originally we're going to do the third season, but I realized that we really had to talk about Stormfront, so we went back and did this. And next, we're going to talk about Season 3, the most horrifying thing I've ever seen, and like Hobbes's Leviathan. I think it's a really good piece for talking about the problem of distribution of power, let's say.
Oh, yeah, interesting. All right, and let's see what our top patrons are making you say at long last, some fresh names.
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you, but as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, a return. Thanks to Alex Benishek. Thanks to You Can Face Reality, Big Easy Blasphemy, Bickering About Morals Is My Kink, wink, wink. Oh my God, that was my worst Patreon name ever, and I kept it for 2 months. Dude, Corey Ebert, Jesta, Neil Polzin is now an elected official. Learn more at neil4covina.com. Congrats, Neil. Jesse Urbanowitz and Brenda Goodman, Alex Arnett, and Ice Cube or Ice Tea, I'm not sure, because I'm like Stormfront, apparently.
Yeah, yes, you are. All right, thanks so much, everybody, and we'll see patrons after dark.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.
Yep.
Uh-huh.